Hello and welcome back to Slycast, and this is a monumental episode. We are covering 1995's Assassins, but the exciting thing here is it's our first new episode where the bulk of the gang is together in quite a long time. I'd hate to actually have to count the amount of months, but I am joined by Jeff Ferry.
Damn hot day, isn't it?
And Mike Kunda.
I'm looking forward to the chit-chat.
And unfortunately, Jeff Hewlett has other commitments, but as always, he's here in spirit. And I just wanted to say that, as you know, this is a show that celebrates and analyzes the career of Sylvester Stallone. Sometimes it's harder to celebrate than others. Mike, I wanted to say to you here, while we're talking on air, you've had an exciting, exciting past year. I just wanted to say that The Pretender is now available to view on tons of different platforms. So if you haven't watched that, go out and do so. We watched it the other night, Mike, and we really, really, really enjoyed it. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. I wasn't sure if you had got a chance to see it. That's awesome. I was hoping you did. Thank you.
Yeah, I missed one of your live sit-downs during the quarantine here. You've been pretty good about jumping on with John Rivoli.
Yeah, Rivoli, Jim Toscano.
Yeah, yeah. So I wanted to ask, what was the filming window for that like? Because I was trying to figure out, you know, time-wise, what was going on. But that you shot over quite a few years, huh?
5 years. Yeah, we started when we met on the set of Balboa. We just started following each other on social media. One thing led to another. And he was, starting his film business, his film studio, Free Age. And he always wanted to do that movie, a fan documentary about Rocky. But he couldn't figure out how. Well, the more he followed me, he thought, okay, there's something going here with this guy. So he thought a 5-minute thing, and that would be it. And it started in 2011, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of 5 or 6 years, he would come back and forth from Detroit to Philly, film. Go back and try to edit it. But the thing was, things kept happening and he had to draw a line somewhere.
Yeah.
It was pretty monumental. But at any rate, it was about 5 years and then 2 years of editing because, you know, it's not like anyone came to him and said, Jim, would you find someone who's crazy to film who's a Rocky nut? He was doing this on maybe someday it would get picked up. And he did a great job, and it did. It got picked up.
Yeah. So there were two sequences I wanted to talk about, if you have a minute. And forgive me if you've covered this on one of your other chats, but the one scene that was really kind of intense was when you were at Rocky's apartment and somebody started giving you a hard time about Sly's lack of contribution to the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Does it often get hairy out there on the streets?
Not anymore because I'm a bit of a fixture. You're talking Kensington, Northeast Philadelphia, where they defecate in the street. They shoot up heroin needles on the side. Bum fights erupt with hypodermic needles. You see a lot of homeless. So now there's a weird thing that happens. When I put the hat on and I do the effect, people love Rocky. No matter how much they've lost in their lives, at one point or another, they were somewhat coherent and are aware of Rocky. So that was actually the worst thing that's ever happened. That guy was, he and Jim toned it down. He was afraid he was going to get sued until I told him, Jim, this guy is dead.
Yeah.
He died. So, you know, but he had already had the film edited. He was much more violent because you would have to think, Jesus, Mike, the guy just smashed a few bottles. You're kind of a big pansy. What are you doing? Like, you know, a little worried about a bottle smashing? Ooh, no. It was much more confrontational than that. And of course, you know, you don't want it to go to that next level. I mean, I'm really good with a chiffon pillow and an electrical blanket. I'm tough, man, underneath. I stay warm and cool. But when it comes to the streets of Philadelphia, it's no way, man.
I was going to say, I don't know the Kensington, the place I want to get in a street fight.
Ooh, you got that right, my friend.
Well, yeah, I thought you handled it well, or at least the way it was portrayed in the film. And yeah, that was a pretty intense moment.
Yeah.
The other sequence that I really had fun watching, Mike, I mean, overall, the entire film's enjoyable. But when you were at that Stallone night at the pizza place, can you give a little insight there into some of the reactions you got from people that were there enjoying their meals, and then Rocky comes over and starts talking to him?
Yeah, that was a lovely little Italian restaurant in Mentor, Ohio, called Mama Roberto's, family-owned for many, many years. The owner, Rick, and his wife, I forget his wife's name, but they were just adorable people. I really, really liked them. He is a Rocky nut job. He's like all of us, okay? But the problem is, it's a real blue-collar neighborhood. And when people come there on a Friday night, they don't see their family all week because they're working. So when they come to dinner, this is where the family goes. This is the Cheers of Mentor, Ohio. And they haven't seen their family all week long, so they're getting together, they're getting caught up, first dates, whatever. And so here comes this lunatic dressed like Rocky going table to table. Now, what maybe you didn't know, there is a banquet hall like directly hooked to this little restaurant. And they had been playing Rocky all night on a loop on like a 100-foot screen. And so, or I mean, a 100-inch screen. And anybody could come and go all night long for free. And you had popcorn, whatever. And it was billed as Sylvester Stallone night. Well, nobody cared. Not one person in that restaurant gave a crap. It was like the equivalent of, I was trying to sell like steak nines. Nobody wanted me to buy them at the table. And you saw how bad it was. I can only tell you, Jim Toscano and his little crew of merry men were so generous to me the way they edited. It was so much worse than what we saw in the movie. The guy in the blue shirt, the old guy, He almost got in my face and told me to, you know, get the F away from his table and, you know, they'll come back. I mean, it was brutal. And so I go to the owner. Did they know I was going to be here tonight? Because I don't think they want me here. And it literally, just like Jim showed, it literally turned around. Those two guys, they had some pity on me and a table from Philadelphia. They had 15 people. They were, I don't know, celebrating somebody's college, something or other. And they took some pity on me and they started laughing, which then turned the entire restaurant around, which I was able to work. And when Jim sets it in time with my father talking about my great failure as a high school wrestler, it seems to work, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And one of the things that I kind of really appreciated about my viewing experience, at least, is I had read your book, Cue the Rocky Music, quite a few years earlier. So I knew some of the beats that they were going to hit in the movie. So it added a little extra level of appreciation. But again, Mike, I'm always so happy to see your successes. And again, if you're listening and you haven't watched The Pretender, if you have Prime Video, it is available streaming for free as part of your Prime membership. And Mike, it's available on all the other platforms, right? iTunes.
Yeah. iTunes, Tubi, Vimeo. There's so many of them. I don't know them. I if anyone wants to know where they can watch it, I have it. I will click and paste and I'll send it to you. And if I could just say one last thing, because it can never be enough about me. Somebody else watched it last week.
Well, he posted about it.
He did post about it. In case anyone is wondering, if you've been living in a cave, if you've been kicked in the head by a donkey at a working farm on a school trip, Sylvester Stallone has actually endorsed The Pretender. And he was very genuine, very nice about it. We saw a sick, sick bounce on Amazon Prime, where it's been trending for the better part of a week.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. You put up that screenshot the other day where it was right next to Last Blood.
Unreal. It's great.
Yeah, and not to get into a whole other discussion, but it was brought to my attention today, actually, by somebody on Twitter who alerted me, and I hadn't realized it, but they are streaming both versions of Last Blood on Prime Video, the theatrical cut, which we saw, and then the extended version, which played overseas, which has the big monsoon rescue.
The opening flood scene, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, that's great. I got to check it out now.
Yeah, if you search it on Prime, you just have to scroll down for it's labeled as the Last Blood extended version.
Beautiful.
So that's pretty cool because I know we all had our kind of ways that we found to watch that scene when the movie came out theatrically.
Yeah.
Jeff, you've also been keeping pretty busy with your other podcast. You want to just give us a little update there?
Well, I mean, I haven't been rubbing elbows with Sly Stallone or anything, and I'm pretty sure The Pretender bump came when I shared it on my Facebook page. It was around the same time. It could have been Stallone, but it could have been me. I'm not sure.
I'm going to go ahead and think you may have had a slightly bigger impact than Sly, so I'm going to thank you right now. Here.
Well, listen, I know you got the Stallone endorsement. I'm going to give you something more important. You're going to get the Jeff endorsement.
Nice.
Here's what I'm going to say. Like, listen, I was already in the bag for this anyway as a big fan of you and a big fan of Rocky. But I'll say this to everybody who watches a lot of documentaries. You know how you sit down and you watch those Tiger King documentaries and you know, stuff like that? And you're like, I hate everyone in this. Watch The Pretender. It's the opposite. You love everybody in it. Mike, his family, his friends. You're like, these are all wonderful people. Why am I not watching more documentaries like this?
Yeah, I know.
Where, like, I'm actually rooting for the people instead of actively hoping something bad happens to them.
Yeah, it's the one documentary where you don't root for the tiger, you know?
Yeah, it's just like you're getting to the end. You're like, I hope everything works out.
Oh, that's so sweet of you. I appreciate that.
I'll tell you how in the bag for it I was. It's getting to the end of it. I'm like, man, I hope this works out. I know how it works out.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, and that's an excellent point, Jeff. You know, we don't get enough of those sort of feel-good stories, and The Pretender is definitely one of those. And again, we're so happy that we were able to sort of be part of that, you know, that journey as you were going along, because I remember when you first joined us on the show, you were probably in the editing stages and we were getting updates every episode. And now X amount of years later to see it, you know, having the success that it is and being endorsed by Sly is just really amazing. And I won't spoil it, but there is a little bit of a surprise cameo in the documentary.
Stick around for the ending, everybody. Stick around for the ending.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So please, even if you're listening to this and you haven't watched it yet, pause it. We'll be here when you get back. And watch The Pretender.
Now watch how I dovetail my cheap plug right into his show. So on the Jay and Silent Bob Minute, my other podcast I do, where we're covering Chasing Amy this year.
Nice.
So if you love that movie, minute by minute, I don't know why, but it's an interesting journey, let's say. But my my co-host over there, Chris, is from Kensington.
Oh, come on.
So just remember when I'm teasing him on the show that he could stick a knife in my ribs at any point.
That's great. I mean, not that he could stick a knife in your ribs. I mean, the reference there, that was – I'm sorry.
Yeah. Every once in a while, he'll try to say that he's from Philly, and I won't let him off the hook that easy. I'm like, no, where are you from again?
All right. So where can everybody find that podcast, Jeff?
It's at duelinggenre.com with a host of other great podcasts. Ours is definitely the we took the smallest franchise. There's like Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter, and then there's us. Just little us. There's Rocky Minute too, but that's some scrub named Doug Greenberg. Don't worry about him.
Those minute shows are lots of fun. If you don't know the concept, you know, they take a movie and every episode is 1 minute of that movie. So a lot of fun. And I believe all three of us have been a guest on Doug's Rocky Minute.
I believe so.
So I know it's been a while, but the three of us were all together for the last episode we covered, which was 1995's other Sly installment, Judge Dredd. And this month we're getting to 1995's Assassin, which I mentioned. And I want to say, if you're a little confused listening to the feed here, once a month I do sit down with Doug Greenberg and Ryan from the Going the Distance, the Rocky series podcast. And we just have a monthly chat about a Sly movie voted on by the listeners. So we did cover Assassins for that show, which is released on this feed. But this episode of Assassins, this is the official Slycast episode of Assassins. So no, you didn't download the same episode twice or anything like that. Apologies in advance for any confusion. But again, this is the Slycast coverage of the movie. And again, I'm really looking forward to running through this. I don't know why.
Yeah, I was going to say, apologies to you, Craig, for having to watch Assassins a second time.
I think it's more just being able to sit down with you guys and run this through, because there's nothing I look forward to more than podcasting with friends. And you guys are both two of my best podcast friends. So, Mike.
Yeah.
1995, Assassins is coming out. Can you paint the picture for us a little bit?
So, 1995, I personally had just been coming out of the police academy, and I was getting into the action movies more, and I was a little, I don't know, I didn't know what to think about Assassins. So when it came out, I remember it wasn't exactly greeted with fanfare and a parade across America, if you will. Although it managed to make a little bit more money than I had expected, if I'm not too far off there.
Yeah, let's look. It looks like it made worldwide, it made $83 million. I don't know what its domestic was. Jeff might have that information.
I don't know. I didn't pull it. The only thing I meant to pull was the budget, and then I forgot.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. It made $30 million in the U.S.
There you go.
It was an R-rated movie at a time when R-rated action movies weren't really too big of a thing.
It's more like middling. It's not like – it's not a bomb. It's just like
– You know, you're right. It's you, Jeff, you're pretty much there. I said the same thing to my wife last night. It's not a great movie, and it wasn't bad. It's like if somebody wore khakis all day long. Okay, it's not a bad outfit. It's just not going to set the world on fire. I thought it was a fine movie. If Antonio Banderas wasn't in it, and if Julianne Moore wasn't in it, and if they had other actors, it would have been a really great movie. As always, I love Sly.
Okay, that's interesting, Mike, because I completely agree with you on Julianne Moore, and I don't think it was her fault. I think it was more the characters, and we'll get into that as we get a little deeper into the movie. Okay. But really surprised to hear about Antonio Banderas, because I thought, you know, his performance is a little hammy. But again, I think that's the way the character was written.
I have to agree with you. I do. The one thing I liked about Antonio Banderas in this was, see, the only thing with him is that he makes me want to, like, get a bar of Dial soap and wash myself. He's just so greasy and dirty always, like, and sweaty. They're so sweaty. Who goes to Puerto Rico and wears a blue denim shirt with khakis, long sleeves? I don't get it. But anyways, the one thing I liked about Miguel Bang was his little Tourette's clicking and shooking. Yeah.
Now, were you there opening night?
Do you think I was there opening night? Of course I was. Were you there opening night?
Actually, Mike, you know what? I don't really recall being there in the theater for this one. I think...
And you call yourself a fan.
I know. Every episode that I do with you, Mike, I expose myself more and more. Jeff, what was going on with you in 95 and Assassins?
95, I was a young man of 17. I was 16. I don't know. I can't do math. I was told there would be no math in this podcast. That's why I do it. Well, I got one better. You think you're a fraud. The first time I saw this movie was about 48 hours ago.
Oh, my God.
And I'd seen bits and pieces of it, and I think, like many people, I thought it and The Specialist were the same movie.
Jesus. What have I done?
I will tell you this. If they told me today that a new Stallone movie was coming out starring Julianne Moore and Antonio Banderas, I'm like, I'm on board for that.
Right.
Like, those are some quality actors.
Agreed.
The problem is, I watch it, and I'm like, ugh. Everybody is given not a bad performance, but everybody's given like a C+. And it's not always them. Sometimes I feel like it is. And sometimes I feel like, oh, well, we didn't write any dialogue for this. The other part is this is another movie that needed to be about 20 minutes shorter than it was. There's some fat in this movie.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. And I wanted to get your opinion on the storytelling aspect in a minute. So let's set the scene a little bit. Assassins, again, came out in 1995. It was directed by Richard Donner, who has quite a pedigree. He directed the original Superman, the motion picture. He's the director behind all of the Lethal Weapon movies. Heavy, heavy hitter. Now, this was, I'd say, you know, past his prime, Richard Donner. But still, it's Richard Donner. It's produced by Joel Silver. You have a screenplay by the Wachowski brothers at the time. And then, from what I understand, it was completely rewritten by script doctor Brian Helgeland. The Wachowskis apparently wanted to have their name removed. And it's a pretty cool concept on paper. So you've got Stallone as Robert Rath, who, not his real name, by the way, is a career assassin. And basically, he is challenged by an up-and-coming assassin who worships Robert, which we can get into that part of the discussion as well. I'm not sure how you really follow the career of an assassin, especially in 1995. And then Julianne Moore plays a hacker who gets caught up in the middle of things. So I did want to ask you guys, and I know a lot of times we talk about when Sly's invested in something, how much better the product is. Now, Jeff, you alluded to the fact that this movie is long. It's, I believe, 2 hours and 8 minutes. I think this would have been a much, much better movie at like an hour 40, an hour 45. Now, Mike.
Yeah.
Separating the performance here, because I think Sly's performance is decent.
Yep.
Do you think Sly was completely out of the loop in terms of creative input?
You see, I don't know. I have a hard time seeing him out of the loop on anything. But it is Dick Donner, and I think a guy like that with his personality and Stallone's, I don't know. I think Stallone gets consulted. I think he gets, I don't know, maybe considered to a degree. But I don't think this was the movie Sly wanted to make. Or I don't think this is what he thought it was going to be. That's what I think.
Okay. Now, you brought up some interesting stuff there. I didn't really think about the Richard Donner connection, because a lot of times when we look back at Sly's movies, he's working with directors that aren't as established. Judge Dredd was done by Danny Cannon, who was so basically a first time director there. Cobra, George P. Cosmatos, who, you know, from every indication, Sly ghost directed that movie. So yeah, having a big, brash, powerful director like Richard Donner could definitely impact things.
Yeah.
Now, also, do you think this was also start of Sly's awareness that, you know, he was sort of losing a little bit of his box office power?
Sure. I gotta imagine the whole Judge Dredd era. Once Judge Dredd was ushered in Assassins, I really think that was the beginning of the end the first time. You know, now he's had that huge resurgence, and rightly so. But yes, I agree 100% with you. Now, has he told me that? No, absolutely not. This is strictly a fanboy's point of view on it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And let's play a little bit of sort of fantasy history here, Mike. Yeah. Do you think there's some, you know, things he could have done differently, let's say, after The Specialist to prevent that? Or was it just a matter of that genre, you know, the big macho 80s action stars, they were going to see a decline regardless.
Total decline regardless. I mean, you could no longer have Bruce Willis walking around with a surfboard hitting a guy saying, "Surf's up!" It wasn't going to happen anymore. It was too much. I mean, you know, Sly has a way of being able to pull that off to a degree, but only if the movie is working across the board. And if it's not, he's going to fall flat and he's not going to look as good as he is or can look. So I don't know. I think there's a combination. The old Rubik's Cube of fate has begun to turn at this point, and Sly's colors weren't locking up at the same.
Yeah, you know what? You made a lot of interesting points there, Mike. And I think you also sort of hit on something that you said earlier, which was, you know, this movie turned out differently than Sly anticipated. And I got to say that this movie tonally, at points, it feels like it's trying to be a smart, brainy sort of 70s era espionage movie. But then you've got like these sort of over the top action sequences. Do you feel that Sly was on board for more of the brainy end of things, which, you know, would have been a nice pivot for him?
I just think that's his natural inclination. I think that he came into the business in an ensemble way and a true actor's actor, Brando, Pacino, De Niro, so on. But I think he has such a great skill in that action genre. I mean, look at him move in the movie. In The Assassins. I mean, you two got to admit, right? Like Miguel Bane, okay, he's okay, but he doesn't move like a stealthy a killer, assassin. I know he kicks in the doors and he's all shaky and nervous. Sly comes in, I mean, he's smooth the way he moves. So you're not going to beat him. I mean, even Arnold can't do that to that degree that Sly can.
Right. Now, Jeff, in terms of the overall arc of the story, what would you do to sort of fix that bloated nature of this film, if at all, if you could?
Well, it's interesting. If you look this up, it has that smell of a lot of Stallone movies in this era where it says you can read into it where it's troubled production, troubled production. Unlike most of them, though, you don't see his name attached to it anywhere. There's a lot of nonsense going on behind the scenes with the writers, and they're thinking about they shop another director in there. They bring Richard Donner in there, but you don't see his name attached to all the shenanigans, but like you said, that's where the tonal thing comes up of you write a movie, then you rewrite a movie, and that's where you start having problems with like – I watched the movie. First of all, the opening scene, the black and white, looks like it's a made-for-TV movie. Yeah. It's like, who the hell shot this? Did you shoot this in 10 minutes? Like, oh, crap. We forgot to shoot the first 10 minutes. It looks like a Hallmark commercial.
Agreed.
Yeah, it does that. It has that problem where they just think by making it black and white, it will instantly make you think that it's old.
Yeah, and it's one of those like – listen, I know Richard Donner's a very accomplished director, but – maybe someone with a little more vision for this part would have been good because it really reeks of like – it's so tonally inconsistent from like – then it just jumps into the next scene where he's in the swamp and you're like, what the hell is going on here?
I love that swamp scene.
I do. It's which a highlight of the movie. Because it's totally ruined by the opening scene. Because you're like, this scene's so good. You know, this is like
– right,
it's
right,
not,
right.
It's not quite as good, but this is like Coen Brothers, like Miller's Crossing type exactly. stuff going on here. But like – it's undercut by the scene before it, and if you want to talk about tonally different, here's the problem. If you like Stallone, how he's acting for the first like third of the movie, you're not going to like the second third of the movie, the second two-thirds. But if you don't like the way he is, then he totally switches. Like in the beginning, he's going for like that ice cold,
yeah, cool, detached.
I'm a killer. Yeah. Even when he's like, I'm going to walk away, he's like, I'm just going to walk away. You know, it's just what it is. Then he becomes more of like the Stallone I think most people recognize where, yeah, he's still a badass killer, but like – he's interacting. He seems like a normal human. So I'm like, I'm guessing that's not Stallone that does that. So like they must have been telling him on the day, oh, no, you know, to be more, you know, personable. And it's like the editors like for the first third of the movie was like, we're going to choose it this way. And the second third, we're going to choose it this way. And now nothing matches up. And if you want to talk about Miguel Bane, I like Antonio Banderas. But what the hell are they doing with his character in this? Is that how assassins are? They're spastic maniacs just kicking down doors. And-
yep. The ones I've met are. Yep.
Yeah. Listen, I understand. He was an assassin like a junkie was an assassin.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Jeff, really no way to fix this?
Not that there's no way to fix it. I mean, here's the what really is irritating about this movie. It's not like – like I watched Judge Dredd and I'm like – you're 10 minutes in. You're like, this movie is garbage. Like there's just – there's no redeeming this. Like – Judge Dredd needs a page one rewrite. Like the whole thing needs to be rewritten and redone. This is just like – there's so many scenes where you're like, you're so close. Like you could have done this if you would have beefed up that female character and given her something to do. If you could have had some reason why Miguel Bane gave a crap about Stallone's character. There's nothing tying them together except like, I'm a big fan of yours. Like who cares?
Yeah.
And then you have the big – Bond villain in the background who's on the computers.
Completely useless reveal too, by the way.
Oh yeah, he reveals at the end and it's like, one, I don't care at this point because it's the last 3 minutes of the movie. And two, if you're going to try to pull that kind of nonsense reveal at the end, the person that walks in better be like friggin' Robert De Niro or something. Yeah. Some like well-known person, not like some guy whose biggest acting credit is Officer Number 2 in Hunt for Red October.
Right, exactly.
I thought for sure, I'm like, I was thinking the whole movie because I hadn't seen it. I'm like, all right, this guy that walks in at the end. Now, I know it's not like, it's not going to be Schwarzenegger or anybody that big. I go, this got to be a character actor. It's got to be somebody I'm going to know. He walks in, I'm like, I don't know who this is. Like, you couldn't get Carl Weathers? Come on, man. Like,
oh my goodness.
Like, Sean Connery would have been the one to walk, something like that, like you're saying.
Oh, or, you know, you could go for a real, like, wink-wink thing. Yeah, you get, like, Sean Connery. You get Roger Moore to walk right. in. You know, you get yeah. somebody where the whole audience goes, oh, yeah, I could see that guy being behind all this. Not like, who's this guy?
And you know what? It wouldn't have been that hard to do either because, well, do you see that guy in that opening black and white sequence? Do they show his face?
They do, but it's totally unnecessary to do it.
Yeah.
Except for that they do the whole thing, I needed to look into his eyes. I shut up. I you don't need that.
Yeah, I almost feel like if you're going to do that, it's easy to sell because you say, hey, you want to do half a day's work for, you know, X amount of dollars? I mean, most actors aren't going to turn that down.
Yeah, you could have picked any, what, like 50-ish, 55-year-old actor yeah. of that era and been like, hey, you want to come in and do this? And if you really wanted, you could throw in a fake Russian accent if you want to. We'll give you an extra $5,000.
Yeah. So I did want to hit on one other thing that you just mentioned because you mentioned the age. And, you know, this is sort of an up-and-coming assassin who is, you know, pitted against a guy from a different generation. Mike, do you feel that Sly was maybe slightly, you know, miscast or he looked too young to sort of have the, you know, the amount of years behind him that they say he did in the movie?
You know, I always – I thought he looked too pretty, as my wife Sue said last night. Mm-hmm. He just looked too pretty as an assassin. Now, that maybe that's the character. Maybe that was the way Sly chose to portray this particular character, which is all good. I don't have a problem with that. But to your point, I just think if he looked a little more grizzled, a little more jowled or something, he just looked too perfect to have lived this hard life as an assassin and then always whispering into the computer, "I'm out. I'm out of here. Who are you, you son of a bitch? I'm out." I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I don't even have it in me to criticize the movie. Again, it was a what does Simon Cowell always say? It was a forgettable performance. It was, you know, and not so much Sly. I don't mean him.
Yeah.
Just the movie in general. But I enjoyed Sly's role. I did.
Yeah. All right. So let's jump in. Jeff, you know, sort of alluded to that opening scene, which sort of sets the table for us, where we see it's obviously in the past and an assassin takes somebody out. And then we cut to the swamp scene, which I think we all agree is a very, very promising scene. And it's basically Sly's Robert Rath retiring another assassin, and he does the noble thing and lets the guy kill himself. Jeff, I know you talked about it a little bit. Do you want to sort of tell us why that scene is so great?
It's great because if the point of this movie is he's going to be this killer that's going to walk away, the other guy in the scene who is not a big name, he's a character actor, but he really carries the scene of like, he starts to plead for his life, and then it's like, no, that's what a mark would do. Like, the guy's trying to keep his dignity. There's a lot of good lines in there about, like, I wasn't afraid till I saw you. I was just wondering why you were wearing those boots. And then they walk out into the swamp, and he's like, oh.
Well, yeah, whatever's in that swamp would have killed him if Sly didn't, right?
Yeah. He's like, he's gotten bit by 3 rattlesnakes since he got out there. My problem with the scene is not a problem with the scene. It's a problem with what happens after it is. Is this supposed to be the thing that puts him over the edge to not want to do this anymore? Because the next time you see him, he's bitching and moaning on the computer. But, like, you're not led to believe, like, these guys were, like, close or anything. He knows who he is, but it's not like these guys were like, yeah, we were friends for 20 years. You know, he's still in man love with Nikolai or whatever, but, like, he lets this guy get the noble out. Like, I didn't feel enough for this guy to be like, oh, yeah, he wanted out after this. Like, why?
Do you think it was just exposition? The guy said, somebody had to take the jobs you weren't going to do. You're so high and mighty with your rules.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I took it kind of as like, it's, you know, it's a sort of loveless brotherhood, if that makes any sense.
Well, and he could have given an out of why he killed this guy now. Like, because he could have said, after he said that, he's like, well, somebody had to take the jobs you didn't. And he could have said, you know, kids aren't a job to me.
Yeah.
Right. And that's it. Then you're like, oh, good. Screw this guy. I'm glad he's dead.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Mike, do you want to talk about the scene a little bit?
It is my favorite scene in the movie. I don't know.
Oh, that's a shame, because that's 5 minutes in.
I know. And it's probably not saying a lot. But for me, I clearly remember that movie being blown away. Oh, my God, Sly's he's an assassin. And they're saying, oh, he's killing people like it in a way that had been different. It wasn't Rambo, you know, yeah. It wasn't Cobra or whatever. This was something I at the time I thought Assassins was a far better movie than what – and I've seen it through the years. And my fanometer for this movie has – come down many years ago. So, you know, watching it again last night, no big surprises there. I just wanted to be a little bit, you know, make sure I didn't miss anything too good. And I didn't. The opening moment to me there in the swamp, I really enjoyed it. I thought they could have done, I don't know, I think you guys said it best. You know, I couldn't kill children. That's it for me. But no complaints there, really.
Yeah. And Mike, you did hit onto something here. And, you know, one of the biggest things that this Slycast has done for me is it's, you know, made me reassess some of the movies that I had overlooked. But it's also brought down movies that I held in high regard, you know, prior to this show, and I hadn't seen either movie in a long time. You know, I thought pretty highly of like The Specialist and Assassins. And, you know, again, I said, we celebrate and analyze Sly's career here. There's a lot of celebrating, but sometimes that analysis gets, takes us to some dark places.
Well, you just said something that reminded me last night during the movie. My wife is playing Candy Crush through most of it because she's been with me for 31 years and we've seen Assassins together probably 6 times, 7 times, whatever. And she said, do you remember your assassin's clothing phase? Mm. And I go, oh, yeah, right. So how Sly dressed is exactly how I dressed for about a year and a half. With the blazer and the sweater vest and the denim shirt and khaki pants and the, you know, and I was like, well, I do like his clothing. And then I sat back and I looked at it. I said, but I could never wear it today because it's so dated.
Yeah. Well, it's that style of khaki. It's like that. It's the certain kind of pleat, right?
Yes, it is. Correct. Ain't going to work today.
No. So from there we get him at home, and we see sort of how he gets his assignments. It's over this, I guess at the time, state of the art bulletin board system or something, you know, an old early internet. Jeff, yeah. You want to try and decode that a little bit?
Oh yeah, you get to hear that wonderful dial-up sound, two, three times in this movie? Yeah. Like, oh my god. Everybody watching this that's like under like 30 is like, what is that noise? This movie was made in 1995, so of course it involves computers and hackers, and everyone's got to type really fast. later on, you can all have a good laugh about how much information is being sent around on the computer. It's like, you know, 400 megabytes. Like 30 seconds of this podcast has eaten up more memory than everything in this. I do like that the mark that he's supposed to hit is the captain from Lethal Weapon.
Yes, yes. That guy took me out of the movie for a minute.
He always reminded me of Richard Donner in a weird way.
He did. He did. I always thought that guy was a cipher for Richard Donner.
I think when I was younger, I may have thought that was Richard Donner. I'm like, wait, this guy puts himself in the movie. I would never do something like that. Yes, I would.
So that pretty much takes us to another big, I think, memorable set piece in this movie, which is the funeral assassination. So this is the Richard Donner lookalike. He's playing a mob boss that doesn't really go out in public too much, but he's at a funeral. So this is a perfect opportunity for him to get taken out. And Sly is hired, and he's there. He's pretty close, and he's got the arm in a weird cast that doesn't reveal your hand. Have you ever seen a cast like that, Mike?
I have. And do you know where I've seen it?
In Assassins.
When you were wearing it?
At Planet Hollywood, I saw that very thing. It's massive. Mm-hmm. It comes with its own zip code and wheels. It showed the gun that he used. It had the whole cast, the little patch. Nobody notices the massive club on the guy's arm that he's got a cape-like coat on. I mean, I don't know.
Well, yeah, so Mike, that brings me to my point of the scene, which is, you know, Sly's doing – he's going to do, like, a pretty close kill here. I mean, he's – you know, he's going to take him out from pretty close proximity, whereas he's beaten to the punch by Antonio Banderas' Miguel, who takes him from more of a sniper's position. What was Robert Rath's escape plan here?
He felt that – and this was notes I had read. He felt that everyone was so stupid at the funeral that they would be overcome by grief. No one would notice the cartridges being ejected from the man's forearm, club-like substance. I don't know. I mean, I think it's one of those things. How does the Millennium Falcon fly? Superman fly? I mean, I don't know. I guess just suspend belief.
Well, yeah, but I think the point here, Mike, and maybe Jeff, you can expand a little bit here, is the seasoned assassin here was pretty much upstaged by the rookie.
Yeah, this is dumb. This should not have been plan A. This should have been like plan C. Like, we're not led to believe that we just know he's an assassin. The first thing we technically don't know it's him, but like he obviously knows how to use a sniper scope and shoot from far away. Why would you choose this as your thing? I understand this is movie logic, and somehow in the movies, when somebody uses a silencer, it's like a duck fart when it comes out. It's like, pew, pew. That is not what a silencer sounds like. It just sounds like a slightly less loud gunshot.
Right.
If somebody shot a silencer anywhere near you, you'd be like, somebody shooting a gun over there.
Yeah.
It doesn't come out like, pew, pew. Like, that's not how it works at all. I was like, so there'd be a loud gunshot. They would look over, and he's either ejecting cartridges or they're going up against his skin red hot.
Yeah.
And there's smoke pouring out of the front of his hand. I'm like, I don't know. I realize everyone here is not a professional detective or an FBI agent. I'm pretty sure they could put that together. even Antonio Banderas, who's technically in a sniper position, is not that far away. What is he, like 75 yards away?
Yeah.
Listen, I'm not a trained sniper, and I could have shot the guy from much further away than that if I had a gun like he did.
He did have a nice gun.
Well, it also didn't seem like this, you know, highly protected mob boss had that great of a goon squad, right? There were like two guys that get instantly dispatched.
Well, that and how many bullets are in him before somebody realizes something's going on? He's got like four slugs in his chest, and they don't notice he's shot until he falls over.
Again, duck farts.
I loved Sly's reaction here, you know, where he's about to take the shot and somebody beats him to the punch. And
agreed.
Great reaction. Again, showing his experience, he instantly, you know, is able to locate the source of that. And we get a little bit of a shootout between him and Banderas, which ultimately culminates with Miguel being caught. Now, Mike, is there anything else you want to talk about leading up to Miguel's arrest?
No, not at this point. The only thing that struck me was Rambo got told by the traffic cop not to move the car for like 10 cars. I thought that was kind of funny. Yeah. In the cemetery, he kept trying to get out of there, and he wouldn't look at the cop. And the cop go, "Hold it, buddy!" Yeah. And I remember my wife said something to the effect of, "Oh, you don't stop Rambo." I don't know. Something should be silly.
I thought that cop was doing pretty good car management, you know, all things considered.
Well, except for the fact no one would be allowed to leave because it'd be a crime scene.
Oh, yeah.
As an ex-traffic cop, I could tell you he was dead on correct. I give him 2 thumbs up on that.
Jeff, anything you want to sort of, you know, talk about that we didn't talk about leading up to Miguel's arrest?
It's an odd shootout in that I guess this was plan B for Banderas. He just decides at one point of like, oh, I'll just give up. I'm probably better off with the cops than with him. And again, the cops only notice him as the shooter. They don't notice the other guy from 20 feet away shooting with casings blasting out of his hand. Again, it's TV cops. They can literally only see 20 feet in front of them, and they have no peripheral vision.
Right.
I think they also cuff the guy and keep the gun, and the gun's still loaded. So that's good work by them.
True.
So obviously we learn later that Miguel allows himself to be arrested because he's got a thumb that he's able to dislocate, which allows him to slip the handcuffs off. And then he's able to break the glass in the back seat of the cop car. Now, Mike, do you want to give any of your personal sort of experience?
Yeah, I had actually, this is something, I was partnered up with a man named Martin Riggs for a few years as a police officer.
And who was able to get out of a straitjacket?
Similar thing, only it was with his shoulder. What are the odds?
I mean, in terms of a law enforcement perspective,
yeah,
the glass in the back seat of a cop car, you're not able to kick out like that, are you?
No. No, you can't. It's thick plexiglass, polycarbonate. It's unbelievable. And there's another thing I'm going to mention in a little bit about a cab in this glass.
We'll get there.
We'll get there.
Yeah, movie glass is hilarious. It breaks always exactly when you need it to.
You know what my favorite movie glass moment is, and I'm sure, Mike, you've seen this, Jeff, I'm not sure, the Carl Weathers vehicle Action Jackson. Do you guys remember that movie?
I remember. I saw it as a young man.
I still have the bullet hole in my head to prove it.
There's a scene where he jumps on the hood of a car, and with his fist, he punches through the front windshield.
Right.
That's my all-time favorite movie glass moment.
Jesus.
Because that's how windshields work.
So we get a little bit of a chase here, right, between Robert and the cop car that's holding Miguel. If and forgive me if this movie gets a little scrambled in my brains.
No, that's what happens next. He dislocates his thumb like you know, your former partner, Mr. Riggs, yeah. You know, also directed by our friend Dick Donner. So he apparently has a real thing about dislocating things. Listen, I dislocated my shoulder and I can't imagine doing anything after I did that. The only thing I could do was tell someone to drive me to the hospital.
Right.
Exactly. That's real life.
Although I will tell you this, putting a shoulder back in, it's pretty much just what they show you. There is no fancy like, oh, well, no, we actually have this very great procedure we do. Nope. The doctor grabs a hold of it wraps a sheet around your arm, puts his foot up on the side of the table, and yanks on it.
Yeah. So the scene culminates with Robert and Miguel both escaping, and then we get to the – do we go back to the hotel, or do we instantly have Robert commandeering that cab because he knows that Miguel's going to be looking for a way out of the city?
So this is where the cop flips over the car, and then Miguel gets his gun, shoots the other cop car. They crash, kill the cops, and then he strips down out of his janitor's uniform, looks kind of like a priest or whatever, and goes off. And then Stallone hears it on some type of scanner thing, goes down to the docks, sees the dropped handcuffs. And this is how we know what a tough, calm, steady hand he is. A giant Rottweiler the size of a Goodyear blimp comes barking, charging to a fence, and he just looks calmly at the dog. So right away, we see he's nothing can rattle this man.
Right.
We also see he has the ability to stop time and the motion of other people, because before the officers died, they were yelling, they were calling officer down on the radio. And right. He somehow beats the cops there and does not see a cop at all. Because if you yell officer down over a radio, I guess the cops don't just show up, like every cop in the department for 30 miles.
Good catch. Good catch.
But does this lead directly to the cab scene?
Yeah, because, well, he starts listening for the cab. Oh, this was one of my I was at a bad point in this. From the graveyard to here, I started really worrying about my enjoyment level of this movie. So I was like, uh-oh, this is starting to look like one of those Stallone stinkers that I get sometimes. When he's monitoring the radio and he's like waiting for somebody to need to take a cab to the airport. Now he seems to be in a major metropolitan area. You're going to pick out the one guy who needs to go to the airport in a cab, and he's like, oh, I hope that's him. Well, I hope so too, because it's like a one in a million chance. I wish he would have had a slightly more brilliant way to track him than, like, I'll just listen to the radio and hope.
It's the most, you know, it's the most convenient movie moment in this movie. And, you know, Mike sort of said, you know, you got to suspend disbelief at certain points. But for me, this one, the whole movie falls apart if he's not able to have this interaction, you know, in the cab with Miguel. So they did a little bit of creative gymnastics to get them together. You know, you get to see the ruthlessness of Robert because he takes out that poor cab driver who he fakes the accident with, removes the ID card, and then miraculously picks up Miguel, who is going to the airport. And then you get what I think is a really great sequence where you see how Robert's mind works. And this is a more calculated, planned hit than the one he was being paid for at the cemetery, because his basic idea is, he's going to look like he's long-hauling his passenger, start an argument with him, and then basically get his passenger to leave the car so he can shoot him. And then Miguel figures this out, and we get a little bit of a, you know, the Hollywood Mexican standoff. Now, Mike, you alluded to the magic bulletproof glass. Do you want to talk about this scene at all?
Yeah. So here's – so again, I thought Banderas was okay here. I thought the way he's talking, he's got these odd movements with his face, Tourette-like reactions. No way I could do that. No way. It was interesting. So he shoots the glass with his gun, and it slightly startles Sly. But it does a thing that I don't get why anybody – why would a trained assassin – shoot in a car if it's if the bullet could bounce and kill yourself.
Yeah.
So I don't know how smart this Miguel Bain is, right? And they're talking and dialogue, and we see what happens with the ball and the kid and all this. And so Stallone tries to I don't know what Sly was doing, or Robert Rath was doing, but he slams his palm like a backhand against his palms against the window of this plexiglass, and it almost shatters completely. That's never going to happen. You're going to hurt some tendons. You could possibly tear the muscle from the forearm. Trust me, I know. I was in a similar situation with a wall, and it happens. So I don't know. I didn't understand it.
It's a shame because it is actually a pretty good standoff, and you understand why they did what they did before this. They were like, we're going to use whatever movie bullcrap we need to get these two guys in a car. Because for whatever your problems with this guy, that guy, the plot, the script, the shooting, and I have a lot of issues with pretty much all that. These two guys can act, and you could tell they were like, we want to get them talking to each other.
Exactly.
Because when they're talking, those are actually good scenes, which is why there's like five of them in this movie.
Yes.
Because they're like, we got to keep these guys together. But it's kind of dumb how they got in there, and you just have to accept that, A, that it's bulletproof glass. They can repel any bullets. You know, it's like the president's limo. It's so good. But there's repelling bullets, and then there's repelling, you know, the backhand from Sly Stallone. That's a whole other level. That's like rocket launcher level.
Real quick on this. When Miguel shoots it, and we see it really makes some damage, okay? That first bullet, like, why doesn't he shoot it three more times and then shoot Stallone in the head?
Yeah.
That, and I thought isn't there a hole? There's like a slot, if you look.
Not in this cab.
Yes, there is. The slot's there. If you look, the slot's there.
So he could have just stuck the gun through and shot him.
Stick my gun through the slot, shoot him.
Then we may be dealing with the two dumbest bounty hunter killers in movie history. I mean, right up there with Jack Walsh and, Midnight Run. Who's the other guy's name? The other bounty hunter?
Oh, I don't know. Goodness. It's the guy from police. Are you talking about the guy?
Yeah.
Beverly Hills Cop?
Yeah, exactly.
The one he keeps hitting with the door?
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to derail. Go ahead, sorry.
No, it's fine. And I guess, you know, I don't think they really cover it too much in this scene, but it's probably worth talking about where we learn that Miguel worships Robert Rath. And again, I wanted to sort of get both of your opinions on this. Like, in 1995, how do you follow the exploits of an assassin like Robert Rath, who he might be the best in the business? But is there like a newsletter or a fanzine or something? I mean,
that's what I was going to say. That there's a fanzine.
I mean, how was Miguel able to keep track of Robert's career like that, especially to also know that he took out his mentor? Mike, do you have any insight there, or is it just sort of?
No, again, here's what I think. Yeah. I think it's done like anything else. How did the black market work before the dark internet? How did anything work? I think they did it through codes. Maybe it was through the want section of the newspaper. There's a certain code. Whoever gives you your job, your handler, the person setting all this up, there must be some type of assassin hotline thing, because back then hotlines were the big thing, you know, like the party hotlines or the people that could tell the future hotlines. That was really big. So I'm thinking whether they did it via code in a newspaper, whether they did it, maybe there was a club of assassins. Maybe Rath wasn't part of it. Maybe he was upper echelon and the junior assassins would get together, because don't forget, these assassins, they don't have any beef with them. To our point in the very beginning at the swamp, the Mark knew all about Robert Rath. So clearly he was being spoken about in this circle. So, you know, I guess we can go there.
Right. Now, Jeff, do you feel that that was a good approach? One of the things I thought about here is it would have been, you know, a little bit, you know, more interesting, at least for me, if, you know, Miguel was less of a sort of, a worshiper and more of somebody who had disdain for Rath. What's your take on that?
Or again, if you're going to make him his like a little sycophant that's chasing him around, have him have some reason for it. Like, it's one of those let us see, not tell. Like, he just tells him, I always, you know, you were the best, so I just wanted to come after you. Like, that's it. That's your only motivation, that he's the best. Like, this is not exciting to me.
Yeah, it's like that, you know, Ric Flair, the, you know, famous professional wrestler, you know, to be the best, you have to beat the best. I'm surprised that wasn't the tagline on the movie poster.
Yeah, and it's just too weak a motivation. If there was, he needed something else, some other reason of like, I understand he takes the mark away from Stallone at some point. Like, maybe Stallone took his mark earlier, or like he said, he kills his mentor, but like, what do we care?
Yeah.
We have no connection to that at all. He could have killed his mentor in front of him, or I don't know. It could have been something else, but here I am saying I want more. I certainly didn't want more runtime added. The problem is, this is not where the fat is. Up to where we're talking about.
Oh, no. It's about to
it's
get.
It's like action, 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 action. It's shortly after this where
the movie goes off the rails.
Things start to come unglued, because there's like three act twos in this movie.
Yeah, and this is frustrating, and we'll talk about it. So, Robert, does he go home, or is he still in a hotel here, Mike?
No, I don't think he – see, I don't know if it was a home. I always got the sense he was in a hotel room. I thought that's where he lived.
Yeah, okay, because that was one thing they didn't really telegraph too well. Like, I know that the bulk of this takes place in Seattle once he gets the assignment to take out Elektra, but I couldn't really tell where his home base operations was. And I would have loved to have seen some of that, you know, how assassins work and how they travel, and we don't get any of that, unfortunately.
Yeah, we don't see Robert Rath's slippers or his robe or, you know, what's his favorite show, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's pretty awesome. But, you know, I mean, like, you know, how does an assassin travel across the country and have access to weapons? Things like that. I think that this movie, not that I wanted to spend more time on it because the movie's long enough, but to see how that network worked, you sort of talked about, you know, prior to the, you know, the internet, how, you know, how people would get assignments, but then also how would you get equipped for a job? You know, if you're taking a job, let's say you're in New York and you take a job in California.
Yeah.
It was the 90s, man. It was pre-9/11. You just take all your weapons right on the plane.
That's true.
Yeah, I guess. So this is really where the movie starts. So Robert logs on, has a discussion with his handler and says, hey, somebody beat me there. And he's ready to leave. And then this guy, his handler, who we're led to believe is a lady for whatever reason, dangles a carrot over his head for what? One last job to take out Elektra, who is a computer hacker, and four buyers of Dutch descent who have a computer disc. Now, Mike, what are your overall feelings on, you know, the sort of one last job concept that the movie sort of embraces?
You know, this is something, if it's done right, you can do it 1,000 times. And Unforgiven. It can work. I don't know that I felt one last job worked here. It was fine. It was fine. I don't have a lot to say on it, to tell you the truth. It was okay.
Jeff?
Yeah, this is the weak part of the movie here where we get the one last job, which we've all seen done, and we've seen it done worse and we've seen it done better. I'd say this is kind of like middle of the road. But like, I got to be not the only one who starts rolling their eyes as soon as they start hearing things like, we got to get a disc, we got to find a thing. You're like, oh, Jesus, yeah. I've seen this movie before. Like,
it's a big MacGuffin, too, because you don't really get an idea of what the stakes are in terms of if that information gets out.
And in a good movie, in a really good movie, it won't matter. You don't care. How many Hitchcock movies have I watched where, like, I don't even know what the frig they're looking for? It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because everything else happening around it is so good. The problem is, at that section of the movie, they let it drag on for so long, and they start introducing all kinds of new stuff, and you're like, I don't care. I like, who the hell are all these people that just showed up?
Yeah, well, I think one of the main problems is the character of Elektra, and we see that she's a hacker, and she lives in sort of this house that's been converted to apartments, from what I can tell. But either way, she's got the whole thing wired up where she's spying on all of her neighbors, which instantly makes her an unlikable character to me. Mike, were you at all uneasy with the way they presented Elektra?
I just thought she was a freaky lost soul. I don't say that to get a laugh, but I think she had a little freak side to her. I think from what we're learning about her is that she has no life, no family, nothing. She's basically a ghost in this world. She's a young woman who just comes across as very lost. She doesn't even know really who she is. She's in over her head. She's almost I was okay with it. I didn't have too much of an issue. They got to portray her some way. Why not like this? So,
yeah, I think, though, you take a little bit of the sympathy away, though. And we could be sort of, you know, splitting hairs here or, you know, agreeing to disagree. Jeff, what is your overall take on the introduction of the Elektra character?
Well, what I don't love about her is the way they introduce her is not the way that she ends up being through the rest of the movie. They introduce her as very capable. She seems pretty tough. She's one step ahead of everybody else. And I understand that's going to get – her rug is going to get pulled out from underneath of her. But then she, 15 minutes later, is like the damsel in distress.
Right.
Of just like, oh, well, now I'm not capable of doing anything. Like, oh, she kind of gets her crap together later on. But I would have preferred her to be a more capable ally to be with him. Of like, I understand she's not into guns and all that. But like, she could have – helped him out in the mission some way. Maybe all the surveillance crap that were shown earlier could have like come into play a little more.
Oh, right.
Where it doesn't, where it's more of just like, hey, it's nice to have a sidekick along, isn't it? And maybe someone who inexplicably is going to be a love story, which I prayed would not happen. I'm like, as soon as she showed up, I'm like, please don't try to make this a freaking love story. And they just had to jam it in there anyway, didn't they?
Oh, they shoehorned it in. As far as I'm concerned, she's no Kobayo. She could not live up to the red velvet dress in Vietnam. No way.
Well, the shame is the actress could.
Oh, Julianne Moore. Oh, she's a great actress.
And they start her out, and it seems like they're going to do that. Like, when she's first talking to the Dutch guys on the phone, she's on top of it. I want this. We're doing this. She gets to the hotel. She's like – and I understand for a little while she's going to be off her footing because that's the way movies work. But, like, she never totally gets it back. She never gets quite as bad as, like, oh, I need a fainting couch or anything like that. But this movie does have a little 1995 on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think when I sat down with Ryan and Doug to talk about this, I said it's like the most 90s looking movie I can remember. This is a 90s time capsule from the wardrobe that Mike talked about to all of the tech we see. It definitely wears its 90s stamp proudly. So we get now to, I think, it's got to be like, it feels like a 45 or 50 minute long sequence at the hotel. Do either one of you guys want to be champions and attempt to decode this scene for me?
Jeff, you want to go ahead? Because I have just two short builds on this, so go ahead.
Oh, well, what I really enjoy about it is Stallone pulls a gun on some guy in the hotel lobby for no apparent reason because he vaguely has the same hair as Antonio Banderas.
Oh, and then he tells the guy to get a haircut.
He tells the guy to get a haircut. Well, like Mr. Brilliant Assassin, that could have blown up your whole day because all that guy has to do is walk away and tell the cops, hey, you see that guy over there? That maniac just pulled a gun on me.
You think he shaved his head the next day?
Oh, I mean, wouldn't you? If some guy who has that Stallone look on his face tells you, like, get a haircut, you're like, well, I guess it looks like I'm shaving my head for the rest of my life.
Happens to me all the time, fellas.
Mike's just walking around.
I'm just walking over.
Telling people, get a haircut.
Get a haircut. People go crazy.
Oh, yeah. So they're supposed to make the MacGuffin drop here with these Dutch buyers that we have up here who we've been told that Miguel is supposed to take out. That the contract is for all four buyers and her. Well, that's a hell of a contract, too. They got to take out five people. That's nice. By the way, the Dutch people are all speaking German, so, you know, there you go for accuracy. Luckily, Sly is able to lure the guy out and take over his little computer console to try to find her. And then he eats the guy's banana, which, I mean, that's not cool. That's that guy's lunch, man.
That's not right.
I didn't notice the first time that he took the guy's banana to eat it. I thought he brought it with him. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, you're going in there. Like, all right, I got some assassin stuff to do today, but, like, I need my potassium. So, like, I need to have this with me. Yeah, so there's a very long, drawn-out scene of these guys going in, and we see she's down the hall, and she's got a fancy system involving a toy truck to move the money, which you'd have to be a complete idiot not to know that she was right down the hallway at that point.
Well, Miguel figures it out pretty quick, right?
Yeah. And if something's coming down the air duct, unless you're using weird physics, it's not coming up or down because that wouldn't work. It's got to be coming from the other way. What's there, like six apartments down the other way? Obviously, it's one of them. But, I mean, the fake Dutch guys don't care about it because, shockingly, they're not really Dutch guys. They're all Interpol. Like, who cares? Like, but again, I brought that up. Does that have any bearing on the rest of the movie? Nope. Doesn't matter.
No, I think there's an attempt to, like, just confuse you here with the idea that, oh, if we confuse the audience, they'll think we're being intelligent or we're, you know, the movie's more intelligent than the viewer.
Well, he kills, what, six Interpol agents here? So pretty sure, I understand you're an international assassin and you're super awesome. I think the heat's on at this point. Forget about Stallone. You're going to have like a million other people looking for you. Oh, you do get Miguel is freaking out during this whole part, which that's pretty fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was good. I like that. The one thing that, well, two things I have to say, but one thing that everybody missed was at the end of Die Hard, a lot of people don't know this, but there were four guys who made it away from Hans Gruber's crew. These Dutch guys, they weren't Interpol. They were actually part of Hans Gruber's team. So that's number one. And number two, did you guys notice the heavy-handed messaging with no fur and the NRA and pro-choice?
That's total Dick Donner.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, very heavy-handed.
I mean, look at the Lethal Weapon movies, especially, I mean, pretty much everything after the first one.
Yeah.
It's like you got your anti-apartheid, and then you have, like, the immigration one. Yeah, it's...
Yeah, I... Because I'm not as big into filmmaking as maybe you guys are. I'm a little shallow into the pool when it comes to a lot of that. So when I saw that, I'm like, my God, these are like three major messages. We see Elektra with the spraying of the paint. So the lady in the fur coat doesn't smell.
No, the whole paint? Elevator. Oh my God. I think they all would have passed out, Mike. Right?
Yes. I mean, who's farting that smells like paint? It's not that. I mean, it's a paint can. She's got to be pretty stupid. And then, of course, there's the big chase scene in the car with on the bus NRA with mm-hmm. the circle on it. The gun goes flying. That might have been back in the cab scene with Stallone and Miguel Bane. I don't know. And how does Miguel Bane, how does he survive being scrunched between a cab and a bus? Jesus.
He even references it, doesn't he?
I believe.
Oh, listen. You pretend like that's the most death-defying thing he's going to do in this movie. He must be – he's half Mexican and half Gumby.
Oh, yes, my goodness. Agreed.
So I don't know if we completely decoded that scene or not, but I think one of the things they could have done is – so this is sort of an aborted attempt, and then we get another exchange where Stallone is going to trade the disc for money, and then it turns out he's double-crossed and the briefcase is basically it's set to explode instead of contain money. Do you guys both think that this scene was extraneous? I mean, it gives us that whole kind of, you know, elevated tram system sequence. But to me, it seems like it all could have been contained within that one hotel sequence.
I'll tell you how bad it is. What you're talking about, you even forgot where they go back to her house.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah, they go back to her house first. And then Miguel ends up killing the two.
Okay.
The neighbors who were fighting earlier.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Again, I'll tell you how important that scene was. You didn't remember it. It didn't affect the movie at all.
Wow. That's yeah, true.
If they never went back to her place, would it have mattered?
Oh, yeah. So, honestly, so when she's escaping the hotel, she leaves the cat behind, which I thought the cat was sort of a nice little touch. And I believe we alluded to this when I talked with Ryan and Doug that, like, it kind of shows her possibly – you know, way before this was even a thing, like, you know, being on the spectrum a little bit in terms of, you know, that's sort of her security that she needs. The cat is almost like a therapy animal and she loses it. And that's how Stallone tracks her back to her apartment. And then Miguel tracks her based on a photograph that shows the radio tower, right?
Oh, how easy is that? I mean, that's perfect. No map, no GPS, no Waze. Nothing.
Like if he did that today, I'd be like, okay, well, he put it in like into Google and he was able to image search yeah. it. It would have been one thing if he recognized something in the background, like, oh, there's, you know, the Space Needle and I can see it and I can use the position of the sun to somehow figure out where it is. No, it was just a random building. So apparently he has like the whole entire skyline in Seattle memorized.
Right.
I mean, that's a hell of an assassin. He had to study for 3 years to go on this assignment.
Yeah, I guess.
Right. Now, do you guys sort of think that there was any way they could have done this sort of double cross without adding another sort of extended scene that just makes it, you know, that much longer before we get to the climax of the movie?
I think they needed to pick one of the five locations they run to in the middle of this friggin' movie and just like they do the hotel and her house and then they go to the train station and they go to here. Oh, at her house is where he gets blown out the window, by the way.
Oh, my goodness. Wouldn't Miguel's hands have been completely incapacitated after that explosion?
Well, I mean, besides the fact that he's – what's the word for it? Dead. Yeah, he's super dead. He got blown out of a third-story window. Even if he's alive, he's certainly not getting up and walking off.
You know what I love in that scene, Mike? Yeah. As the explosion's happening, Robert picks up a coat and he sort of covers Elektra's head with it.
Oh, yeah. It's made out of, like, pleather. Oh, thanks. That's just what I want to stick to my face.
One of the deleted scenes, I don't know if you guys stuck around and watched the deleted scenes at the end. It turns out that Miguel Bane, his bone structure is covered with unobtainium. And so he was able to survive. No problem. No problem.
I thought he might be, like, a T-1000 sent back in time to look for Stallone in a little you know, crossing franchises a little bit.
Now we have a makings of a good movie. Yeah. Thank you.
So they get away and she puts on Chekhov sunglasses.
Oh, Hernal's sunglasses.
So he takes her back to some hotel or safe house or whatever the hell he's got going on.
Yeah, so this is after Rath is double-crossed. He contacts his handler. He demands an increased fee now, and he sets up an exchange at the bank in, is it Spain or Mexico? It's Spain, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we forget one thing, though.
Okay.
The one, and this is all, I have to give my wife credit on this. She picked up on this before I did. I think I knew, I just forgot. So now we know that Robert Rath is the mark now.
Yeah.
Antonio Banderas has been given a picture on whatever that laptop is.
God, how long do you think it took to download that?
Did you all pick out what the picture is of Sly from what movie?
Oh, no, it's from another. Is it from The Specialist?
No, it's from.
I thought it was Tango and Cash.
No. It was the picture after the funeral in Over the Top, and they're playing the music, and Sly's sitting on the back of the truck looking out at the ocean. There's that shot. It's perfect. And so my wife, she didn't know what the shot was, but she goes, look at that. That's a shot from one of his other movies. And I, the second I saw it, of course, I knew what it was. So I Googled it, and the shot came up, and I showed her, and she goes, oh, shit, that's pretty good. Anyways, I wanted to give my wife a shout-out and credit on that one. That was all her.
That's great. That's great. I love that. I love that.
I love when they do stuff like that, when they use a publicity still from something else. We just did we're covering Chasing Amy, and at the very beginning, there's a picture of the two artists. It's Ben Affleck and Jason Lee in the comic book, but the actual picture is from a scene later in the movie.
Ah.
So it's a picture of something that hasn't happened yet.
Oh, that's
yeah, Rocky
great.
IV is famous for that.
Yeah. So you alluded to the fact, Mike, that Rath has become the mark, and Miguel is ecstatic to finally get the assignment, which is to take out Robert Rath. And then we basically get a retelling of what Robert went through when he killed his mentor. And this is a sequence I think really, really, really could have worked if the middle part of the movie wasn't so sluggish. But by the time we get here, I'm exhausted. I don't know how you two guys felt, but it was such a chore to get there. But the final lap of this movie, you know, Rath telegraphs it. He's going to have Miguel up in this sniper's nest, and he's going to be doubting himself. I love the setup of it, but I kind of feel like it took us so long to get there that I didn't give a shit anymore. Mike, is that a similar feeling?
Yeah. The long drawn out of it. See, I'm not a fan of chase scenes. I don't like car chases because they're all the same. You go fast, you hit a few things, you go up and down hills, and somebody gets away. The podcast in the Star Wars, the prequels or whatever. I hate all of that stuff. That kills it for me. And there's just a slow. Again, it's the khaki blah for me. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I just looked it up. They hit the hotel at 39 minutes. That's when they're going to the hotel to start all the shenanigans.
Oh, wow.
Puerto Rico starts at 1 hour and 22 minutes.
Oof.
Wow.
That's 40 minutes in the middle. Like, that 40 minutes could have been, like, a tight 25.
Right?
Like, there could have been 15-year minutes right there.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So, Jeff, what are your feelings sort of about, you know, the way that Robert telegraphs things at the end?
At the very, like, what end are we talking about?
Yeah,
there's multiple ends to me. Because I got to be honest, as much as I said they got to cut that middle part, even the Puerto Rico section seems like it goes on, like, a little too long. It feels like they really get to, when they get to Puerto Rico, they really get to lounge around for a while before Miguel shows up.
Who wears a long sleeve denim shirt and khakis in Puerto Rico where everyone is clearly sweating?
Oh, I got a whole other problem with that. So,
shit.
Let's break down what the final scene's going to end up with. The whole thing at the final scene, what he's trying to set up, what our boy Robert's trying to set up is he knows that Miguel's going to want to replay how he killed his friend Nikolai. So he's going to have to go in, get the money, and come out. And when he comes out, Miguel's going to shoot him. Boom. All right. What Miguel doesn't know is he's got Julianne Moore with him to help him.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So he's like, I'm going to leave him up there all day. And then he's just going to get so frantic, he's going to have to leave. Why? He's an assassin. He's a sniper. They're literally trained to do that. Snipers will stay in the same position for 3 days and never move. to get one shot. Like, they show him up there, and he's, like, sweat pouring off of him, and he's drinking out of a water bottle, and then he's peeing into the water bottle, and then he shakes, and he gets the piss all over himself. And I'm like, this guy is a worse assassin than I am.
Shemp would have been a better assassin.
He didn't plan for this. He didn't know, like, oh, I'm going to have to sit up in that bell tower all day. It's going to be hot as hell. I better bring, like, a lot of water.
Yeah. Man. It almost seems like Rath had done a little bit of a psychological evaluation or some psychological recon on Miguel to know that he was sort of anxious. And Mike had sort of alluded to that tick he has. So we could tell that he's a little jumpy.
He seems more like a – if you would have told me that Miguel had done – had assassinated many people, had killed people, but he always did like mafia-style hits, like up close and personal – I would have believed you. I'm like, all right, I see this guy kicking down a door and shooting somebody in the face. That I
get. So he doesn't have any sniper experience.
Yeah, he doesn't strike me as the, you know, sit a three-quarters of a mile away, you know, gauge the wind, the curvature of the earth, and shoot somebody. That does not see me at all.
Yeah, so who makes that decision in the acting? Is that him? Is that Donner? Like, who says look less competent as an up-and-coming assassin?
It's got to be Donner, because if he does it and Donner doesn't like it, he's going to say, no.
Do it
a different way. Yeah. If this was a different Stallone movie where it was one of those ghost-directed ones, I could even throw that on Stallone and say, well, he just overpowered the director.
Yeah.
But, they're not over – at this point in his career, they're not overpowering Richard Donner. He's like, no. We're going to do it my way.
Yeah.
You're getting your $15 million. Go sit over there.
Yeah.
So there was a technological thing we missed here we didn't talk about yet. A while back when this film came out, one of the things, being as hardcore as I was, I remember reading about what they did with the camera. The first thing that had been done ever in a movie is that the camera was able – they did a technique. When Stallone is in the room where he killed Nikolai earlier, he's standing there recounting the story to Elektra, who's standing several feet in back of him. By rights – Stallone would be in focus. She should be somewhat blurred.
Yeah.
When you watch that, they are both in focus. And you can see on Elektra's right shoulder, you can see the blur is happening there, but she is clear. And I don't know the names of the camera, the technique, but this was a big to-do in Assassins, and I have seen it in movies since. So from that point of view, that's a big success. Do you guys recall anything like that?
Oh, that shot was one of the more memorable shots of the movie, and I'm glad you illustrated that was something that was, you know, sort of innovative for the time, because again, like you said, there wasn't a lens that existed that would allow you to have, you know, both of those characters that were so far apart from each other both be in perfect focus. So very, very cool. Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, that was kind of cool.
Oh my God, I almost forgot that there's like a random shootout the night before at the at the cemetery.
Yeah.
Where she wanders off, because that's a good idea when an assassin's looking for you.
Yeah.
And this is where I got to admit, I rolled my eyes a little bit to the point where they were rolling around like I thought they were going to come up, you know, three cherries in a row, where Stallone saves her and she's looking at him like she is just thirsty for Stallone.
Oh, right.
It is an acting choice, and she goes for it.
Yeah. Well, again, this is the frustrating thing about this movie that we talked about earlier, is I kind of feel like if Stallone was a little bit more invested, he could have pointed out some of the story problems that could have made this a really, really classic film, and instead it kind of makes it a middling, forgettable one.
I believe in my heart, if Stallone had more artistic control, I believe this movie would be something really high on our list. It had potential. It really, really did. It could have almost been like that old 1940s film noir type of thing.
Right.
I really thought, because Sly thinks that way, and I clearly did not see Sly's fingerprints on this.
Yeah, and it's a shame because, you know, again, if this came in at like an hour 45 minutes, maybe an hour 50 with that tightness, and, you know, we've talked about this on this show a million times, and that's why we're all here. You know, Stallone knows what audiences want. He's constantly able to deliver that when he's given the reins. And it's frustrating to watch something that misses the mark, and you know that Stallone would have been able to nail it.
Totally.
My other issue with it is, I'll say in other movies, a lot of times it's Stallone and a cast of not nobodies, but people that are not up to his where he can get. He's actually in a movie with two actors who can play at his level. Like, they can play in the major leagues. And it's with the exception of the few times where they're him and Banderas together, I feel like they're not given the opportunity to. Like I said earlier in the show, if you told me today, hey, there's a new drama coming out, and you just put on the poster Stallone, Banderas, mm-hmm. Moore, dude, I'm there.
Yeah.
Like, I want to see that movie.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
I think we can all agree here that they pivoted a little too much towards the action. And if this was done, and like, I think, Mike, you had mentioned that you thought that Sly signed onto a different movie than we got, you know. If it had a little bit more in common with those 70s thrillers that didn't rely on flashy action sequences, you know, and really just focused on the characters, it's another sort of really, you know, missed opportunity in Sly's filmography. And, you know, all we can do is bemoan it at this point. But it's always a shame to see, because Sly has the ability. And for whatever reason, it just wasn't extended here. So we get the end scene now where the money transfer is completed. Rath says that he wants to close the account, which he knows is going to take a long time. The bank is somehow becomes the middleman for the handoff of this disc. Now, is that ethical at all, even in, you know, a foreign country?
I believe just in Switzerland.
Yeah, right?
Where, let's just say, there's a few things they kept during a certain war and have not given back.
Right, right. So then we get the whole setup where, you know, Miguel has to come down and see for himself whether Robert has left the bank or not. And they have a little interaction in the bank, right, Mike?
Yes.
They have a face-to-face, right?
That's – yeah, but well, because he's waiting. Okay, that's right. So he's been up there. He comes down. Now, Elektra, they're on a two-way radio between – Robert and her, and she's kind of watching for Miguel to come down because Robert Rath kind of knows what Miguel is going to do because he was in his shoes years earlier. So when they come into the bank, Sly's there for 8-9 hours, and he's very comfortable. He's having his tea and a little Danish or whatever, and finally Miguel comes in. And I got to tell you, I thought this was a great scene. Mm-hmm. I thought the way he walked in, the way his incredulous attitude, leaning on the pole, and he goes, "Oh man, you got me, you mm-hmm. got me." And, you know, he really sold it well, I thought.
Yeah, yeah, and that's basically an opportunity for Elektra to take the gun away from him, so when he gets back up to his perch to take the shot, he won't have it.
Yeah,
but then we get the real Hollywood trope where, you know, of course she can't get from point A to point B without falling through a rickety floor.
Right.
So ultimately, they all end up in the rickety building together. Rath shoots Miguel, and then we get the big Nikolai reveal, which we kind of talked about as kind of goes over like a fart in church.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's a resounding, like, here he comes. Imagine all the great reveal you've seen in movies, like, you know, where you finally get the Kaiser Sose reveal, or it's the Avengers Endgame, and like it's the very end. It's like the total opposite of that. Mm-hmm. It's like if they were going to reveal, like, hey, and here's who's going to kill Thanos. Nobody. We're just going to roll credits. You know what? We're not even going to end this movie. Screw it. And it just ends. And you're like, oh, okay. It was just so disappointing. Like, I knew it was going to be underwhelming no matter what, because they had waited so long and hadn't built it up correctly. I'm like, it's already going to suck. No matter who walks out, even if it's Sean Connery, Roger Moore, blah, 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 all the names we've said, even if whoever walks out, it's going to be already underwhelming. That guy's going to be have a long road to hoe. And instead, it's Captain friggin' Russian no-name comes walking out. And you're like, oh, well, this is – that's just wonderful.
And again, it's pointless because basically he's on screen for all of 30 seconds. Miguel shoots him. And then Rath takes out Miguel. You know, after Miguel – he turns his back on Miguel and Miguel tries to get the drop on him. But we also sort of reveal that Sly took a shot to kill Nikolai X amount of years earlier that didn't kill him. Mike, do you at all envision a world where, you know, Rath's haunted by this, you know, the mentor that he killed? Would he not have realized that he didn't really kill this guy?
So here you go. How good is the person's imagination when you're watching this Are you in a few seconds saying to yourself, well, you know, he was just beginning to become the greatest assassin. He wasn't as great as he is today, right? So at that point when he kills him, maybe he gets mistaken. Maybe he thinks he did it. Maybe there was a blood squib. Maybe he turned away from Wrath when he got hit. But the thing that Nikolai says, he goes, Robert, I knew you'd always go for the heart, the heart. So that's why he knew Robert was going to shoot him in the head, because he was predictable. So I ask you this, if you're a predictable assassin, how good could you be considered number one? I don't understand that.
Yeah, this to me, it seemed like a reveal we didn't need. Or at least if you're going to do that, drive home the conflicted nature of the Wrath character. You know, I know they show that he's guilty about taking Nikolai out, but really have that drive his character throughout the whole movie. Yeah. Instead, the reveal is just pointless, and you're so exhausted by the time you get there, you don't care about it. And then it's like 4 minutes and it's wrapped up. I mean, for as much time as they took in this movie, it's a race to the finish line, which, you know, a lot of Hollywood movies have that problem where it's like they're like, oh my God, it's already 2 hours and 10 minutes in. We have to finish this. But here, it just feels to me like so much of that could have been fixed. Don't they do test screenings for things like this?
Yeah, this seems like if you do a test screening for this, you get the note back of like, listen, there's a lot of fat in the middle. You need to cut some of it. Also, reshoot your ending. Like if this was made, say it was made by Disney, who has no problems doing reshoots. This whole ending gets reshot. Yeah. They're like, oh, the hell no. Like, this didn't work. You know, sub this loser out. Get me Gary Busey in here.
Like, oh, my goodness. Yeah. I would have loved to have seen Gary Busey saunter out there.
Like, listen, he may be a wild, insane person, but he will chew the hell out of the scenery for a minute and a half he's on screen.
Yeah, and Donner had his number in his Rolodex from Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, I mean, he was probably out, like, I don't know, chewing on a sofa or something, but, like, you could grab him, get him in there.
Yeah.
I also want to know what body armor this guy was wearing that A, Stallone could not see, because if you've ever seen somebody actually wear body armor, if it's any good,
they're bulked
out.
You
can tell. Yeah. Also, he shot him with a Remington rifle from not that far away. So even if he's wearing body armor, it's probably going through it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the bullet. The bullet looks like one of those pennies that you put into one of those crank machines at an amusement park, and it comes out with the little emblem of whatever on it, you know?
Yeah, it looks like he shot him with a .22
exactly.
From, you know, 500 yards away.
Exactly.
Right.
I don't know.
So I think we did the best job we could sort of running through the movie, and apologies for any lapses in time that I created.
You did fine.
Oh, listen, it's just because you watched the movie longer than like a day or two ago, and you start missing. The first thing that goes is the middle part of the movie.
Right.
That immediately disappears. In your mind, you're like, okay, I remember the beginning, the swamp. He meets her, and then they go to Puerto Rico.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like such a basic movie. I mean, they really could have made like an hour and 45 minute really, really great film.
I'll give you my comparison. Think of the Mission Impossible movies. You could make two different kinds. You can make the kind the first movie was, which was a spy thriller where it's all about getting from point A to point B, which is like kind of what the beginning of this was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Or you can make an action movie, which is what all the new ones have been. What you can't do is what this movie does hang out in the middle somewhere.
Yeah. You know, Sly has a favorite saying he's used over and over whenever he's it's years past a particular movie that didn't do well. He always comes back. He goes, well, I didn't know if it was a feathered fish. I mean, you know, what is it, swimming? Is it flying? What are we doing here? So, you know, I think that's what happened with Assassins. But I do like the very end as they're walking out and Robert Wrath reveals his real name as Joseph.
Yeah.
And then we hear the Rolling Stones playing like a Rolling Stone, or at least I thought it was the Stones.
It was, yes.
There you go. And I love that song. I thought that was great. Is the imagery in the song like a Rolling Stone to keep moving? Is that now he and Electra are going to just keep rolling on, get past this?
You know what, Mike? I was so exhausted by that point. I didn't try and make any kind of connection between the music they were using and the scene, but that's a great connection.
Yeah, Craig's life alert was going off by then.
I agree.
Then he couldn't get through it.
I get it. But you know what shocked me back into coherency, and this is my last point. Nobody did the old look in the sunglasses, shoot you behind my sports coat better than assassins at the end. They made up for everything that got cocked up earlier in the show.
Yeah, yeah. So, Mike, any final thoughts on Assassins before we put it to bed?
I come back to my I think, Jeff, you gave it a C plus, C minus. I gave it a B double minus.
All right. Jeff.
Yeah, I do give it a C, but the problem is that's almost like damning with faint praise, because I could see someone going back and watching Judge Dredd just to watch the train wreck of it all.
Yeah.
Where, like, if you ask me down the road, like, it's 5 years from now, if you're like, would you rather watch Judge Dredd or Assassins? I'm probably going to say Judge Dredd, because I'm like, I remember that movie being crazy. Mm-hmm. Where Assassins is like, I remember that movie being okay. Like, better than The Specialist, I guess. If only because you hired a higher caliber of supporting actors.
Yeah.
And you had a director. I'll just end right there. You had a director. Mm-hmm. Like, if there's one thing I've learned with Stallone, he needs to either be in charge of the project or have somebody who is in charge who knows what the hell is going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
There's got to be a strong hand running it. It can be his. Actually, it can be his now. It could be a little worrisome if it was his in like the 80s and the 90s. Uh-huh. Things. He also does need someone to be there like, hey, Sly, hey, when we back this down a little bit, I'm getting a little crazy now.
Right, right.
He needs a certain level of power, but unchecked power can also be a problem.
Jeff, can I piggyback on something you just said?
No, you may not.
So, with Sly, and this has nothing to do with anything, I got to say this because anybody who's listened to our debates, are going over things over the years, they know where I stand on Rocky IV. When Sly was asked via his questions a few weeks ago on Instagram, he literally listed Rocky IV just above Rocky V as his second to worst Rocky. I was so validated in that moment. I really had a nice shot and did some dancing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's incorrect. So I mean,
it's amazing, and I'd love to have. I believe we're coming up on the 35th anniversary of Rocky IV in November. So I'd love to have a 35th anniversary episode of Slycast. But Mike, it continues to boggle my mind at how highly rated Part 4 is, even after the weight that's added to it because of, you know, from Creed 2.
Yeah. That's the thing. You know, Sly he cashed in on the money for that. That's exactly what that was. And I don't mean that in a bad negative light.
Sure. Yeah.
It was a brilliant stroke of genius on his part. It also is the Rocky that made the most amount of money. Hands down. Yeah. I get it. Yeah, on tours, people like two movies, Rocky I or Rocky IV. That's it. I mean, that is their favorite movies. And every once in a while, Rocky II pulls up the end. I understand the appeal of Rocky IV, but at no point do we see Rocky. We see Sylvester wearing Rocky's clothes.
Right.
Gone is the guy's all right. I'm sorry.
Oh, listen, we've all had this discussion before. Like, I told when we first went through these movies, I said Rocky I and Rocky II exist in reality. Rocky III and Rocky IV are in comic book world.
Yeah, well said.
And
well
I'm
said.
Totally fine. And I'm totally fine with that. I accept that for what it is. I'll tell you what blows my mind more than people that say Rocky IV is their favorite. Yeah. Like, part of my mind understands why. It's not my favorite. I enjoy it more than others.
Sure.
But I'm seeing a lot online now people saying Rocky II is their favorite.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
And I cannot wrap my mind around that at all.
I get it.
Not because it's a bad movie. I like the movie, but like, if you like that type of movie, there already is that type
of
movie.
Well, it's
called Rocky.
It's the ending, though, right, guys? Because Rocky II, we get the ending that we were denied in part one. I mean, I think we all appreciate the victory that Rocky has at the end of Rocky. But for people that maybe don't go as deep, Rocky II delivers a true victory.
That may be the one that if you say that's your favorite, I have questions about you. Like, I could almost accept any other Rocky as your favorite. Like, if you told me Creed was your favorite out of all of them, I could be like, all right, well, I get it. You're probably younger and, like, it speaks more to you. I get it. If you were like, Rocky II is my favorite, I just went like, what? Like, how?
Here's a quick very short story on Rocky II. You're going to love it. So, Talia Shire was interviewed by a friend of mine And he asked her how she felt about the ending. And he said, what do you mean? And he goes, they filmed two endings. And she goes, no, there's only the one ending of me in the ring being lifted by Rocky. And he goes, what? And she goes, yeah. He goes, no, no, you're sitting on the couch with Paulie cheering because you were sick. He said, the rumor is that they had to film you sitting on the couch with Paulie because you had to go do that movie about the crazy atomically altered bear prophecy or something. Okay. And she couldn't be there to film, and Stallone had to shoot around that. So why do we have the two versions? There's the one version where she is in the ring, and then there's the one where she's home. She swears she never saw the Rocky II end with her and Paulie. I can't believe that.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
I don't know. I'm dumbfounded by that. But anyways.
Yeah. Well, you know what's funny about memory, Mike, is at the moment when something's happening, you might not realize the significance of it and yeah. its importance to other people 40 years down the line. And memory is a hell of a thing, right?
Well, you're right. We know it from people being questioned by the police. They can see the same thing and people remember 10 different ways. So I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I always love talking Rocky with you guys. And again, hopefully we can all sit down for I always love our anniversary edition shows. We did it for Cobra's 30th and I think we did it for Rocky's 40th. So, yeah, I would love to do Rocky for
sweet
35th anniversary.
Craig, I got to be honest. I'm almost afraid to ask this question.
Yes, sir.
Which movie's next?
Okay. So Assassins is officially put to bed. We never need to think about that movie again. The next movie on our list is basically, I think, you know, Sly's swan song is probably in terms of putting the action hero to bed. And that is 1996's Daylight.
Loved it.
Yeah, I mean, after Daylight, Sly's career changed, right?
It did, because he was so foolish in what he said. He went around to every talk show saying, oh, I'm done with action. I have no more. I want to get back to ensemble pieces. No, Sly, we still are. You're bankable overseas with millions and millions of dollars. So, you know, shed the 50 pounds, get back down to the cut abs and big shoulders. We need you. And he said he didn't want to do it anymore. And I'm like, but then it all came out where he did that to supersell Copland, which yeah. I can't wait to get to that.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, next episode we will talk Daylight, and then immediately after that will be our Copland discussion. And we're now getting into a very, very interesting point in Sly's career. So it should make for two great, great episodes. So, guys, I was a little uncertain of how our Assassins discussion would go, mainly because I didn't keep the best notes in terms of trying to follow the plot, which is something.
There's no point. There was no point. You were fine.
I'm normally guilty of. But, guys, again, good job. And, Mike, where can people find you if they want to follow everything that you have to offer?
Follow me on Instagram, the Yo Philly Rocky Film Tour. That is the best place. That is where I'm the most active. And also, that is where the best parts of me come out. Other social medias, I can be a little combative on a particular topic. But I don't do anything like that. There is no controversial topic for me on Instagram. It is nothing but a love fest of silly fun things. So follow me there, people. Thank you.
Excellent. And I'll include that link in the show notes. Jeff.
Thank you.
If you're looking for me for some reason, I'm over at duelinggenre.com doing the Jay and Silent Bob Minute, where we're breaking down Kevin Smith's movies featuring Jay and Silent Bob minute by painstaking minute. We did Clerks. We've done Mallrats. And we are about two-thirds of the way through Chasing Amy.
Nice.
And we still have about four more movies to go. So it's a very interesting way to look at a movie. Imagine looking at any movie minute by minute. Imagine looking at this movie minute by minute.
Goodness.
I take that back. Don't do that. Yeah. Don't do that to yourself.
I think there'd be a suicide on air.
No, I hear North Korea does that to spies.
So
We said this movie was the most 90s movie ever. Chasing Amy is the bridge between this movie and what will become the 2000s.
Beautiful.
So I'll include a link to that as well, Jeff. And guys, again, I want to say that I value our discussions so much, And it feels so good to be back in the saddle with you guys doing a proper Slycast. And I gotta say, guys, it feels like we barely missed a beat. Jeff, I know, Jeff Hewlett's here in spirit. Hopefully he's with us next time. And, I want to thank our listeners who have stuck by us, as we've, you know, sort of put out content. We put out our big Creed 2 super special, which I think was really, really enjoyable. If you haven't listened to those episodes, I had a great discussion with you, Mike. I had a great discussion with Doug, with Ryan, and Sean Malloy from the I Must Break This podcast, which is basically the Slycast version of Dolph Lundgren's career. So check that out. Yeah. But again, I want to thank the listeners. I get so much offline feedback from listeners after they've listened to episodes, you know, sort of giving us their thoughts and things like that. And don't be shy to do that online. We're on Twitter and Facebook, easily accessible there. I'll include links to both of those. But again, I can't thank you guys enough, you listeners, because, you know, this is basically, you know, you make what we're doing worth doing. And again, Mike and Jeff, I can't stress the value I find in sitting down with the two of you. And it really feels like always an honor and a privilege to do so.
Right back at you, brother.
Just so glad to be here.
All right. So we will see you next time for Daylight.
You dress so fine, do the bumps of diamonds.